Welcome to the Romney Hood versus Obamalani. Did I get that?
I thought you did.
Did I get that?
I thought you got it.
Edition of It's All Politics from NPR. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon. And Ron, the last podcast before the naming of a vice president.
We think. And it's entirely possible we won't even get through this entire podcast before Mitt Romney names his vice presidential nominee.
Well, there's some talk about it could be as early as this week, as soon as this week, before his four-day bus trip.
Makes sense. You want to do it before you get out on the road in that bus on Saturday. Makes sense to have the big guy or the big woman with you if you're going out there to talk to the voters.
Of course, if you name the VP early, then you're not going to have Marco Rubio and Bob McDonnell and all those people on the bus trip. But my guess is that the bus trip ends Tuesday in Ohio.
Oh, what a coincidence. It ends
in Ohio. And that is the place
where
Steve LaTourette.
No, we're not going to talk about him this week.
What, really? You're over that syndrome?
Yes. I think we are going to move on to the other son of Ohio, the other favorite son of Ohio, and that would be
William McKinley.
Let me check his name.
Rob Portman.
How does he pronounce that?
Portman.
Rob Portman. Now, this reminds me of that old joke we had about Al Gore and the Secret Service. What is Al Gore? Al Gore is so dull that the code name for him that the Secret Service uses is
Al Gore.
Now, this could be another Al Gore.
Look, Al Gore didn't knock anybody's socks off in 1992, and it was in many ways, a perfect pick for Bill Clinton. They got along well. They were similarly matched. And I think Rob Portman, again, he won't knock your socks off, but he's a dependable guy, a solid debater, and he won't embarrass you.
I think you're absolutely right. Al Gore in 1992 was the most beneficial vice presidential pick in recent history.
And nobody predicted it. Nobody predicted it.
Nobody saw it
coming. Because there was no difference.
They were too much alike.
Right. No geographical balance, no ideological balance. They were the same guy, and yet it worked.
It worked well, and I think that's the model that Mitt Romney, given the way he makes decisions, is likely to focus on.
We've said for months now, or at least
We think it's going to be Rob Portman. And as we know, anytime you and I agree on something, there's no chance that's going to be.
Well, I'm usually wrong, and sometimes it's fun to be, you know, out of the box. But it's one thing to say, look, Rob Portman is predictable. We've gone through this for weeks and weeks and weeks, and now it'll be such an anticlimax if it is indeed Rob Portman. But at the same time, if you look at all the alternatives, nobody else seems to work.
No. And in fact, I think Mitt Romney wants that set of characteristics that a lot of people look at Rob Portman and say, he's not that exciting. He's really not going to, you know, add much zing to the ticket. He's not a Tea Party guy. He comes from a swing state, yes, but it's not clear he gets you that swing state, so you could still lose there. In fact, half the people in Ohio don't even apparently know that he's their junior senator. So
they think he's his senior senator?
No, they think that he's possibly somebody who is, you know, coming up on the roster from the Toledo Mudhens. I mean, they don't really know who Rob Portman is. It's not that, you know, sticky a name. It doesn't really do things.
He's only run statewide once. That's true.
And he won. It was an easy election in 2010.
Right.
And it wasn't terribly controversial. It was a tremendous Republican year, and all the focus was on Governor John Kasich.
But he's solid, and he doesn't have the kind of ambition like, for example, John Edwards had when John Kerry, every time he campaigned, he would have to turn around to see what John Edwards was up to in many ways.
In many ways.
So Rob Portman, I think, doesn't get rid of that Newsweek cover that is Romney and the wimp factor because, you know, he's not so strong. He's kind of like the white bread Mitt Romney.
You mean he's not Chris Christie?
Yeah, but Chris Christie you want at a convention, rallying the troops, hooting and hollering, but you don't want an embarrassment on the campaign trail of saying intemperate things that only Chris Christie and Ron Elving say.
That's exactly right, and that's why neither of those two people will be the vice presidential nominee. It's so easy to eliminate any of these people, really, until you get down to the last couple. We've talked about Marco Rubio how many times and how he brings you four things you don't otherwise have: youth, the Tea Party, somebody who speaks Spanish, and Florida.
Maybe, but he brings you Florida maybe the way Rob
Portman...
I think
it's more than maybe with Rubio in Florida. I don't see it necessarily in Ohio.
But it seems like the name that, once again, the Washington insiders are talking about.
And I hate those Washington insiders.
You know something? There's something about this city that's so insidious in
yes.
the fact that one person mentions it, then everybody says the same thing.
Insidious?
Insidious.
Just writing that down. Yeah.
I'll tell you how to spell it. Insidious. Well, anyway, and it seems to be about Paul Ryan, the House Budget Committee chairman, who is young and attractive and seems to have a little connection dynamic with Mitt Romney when they campaigned together.
Yeah, there was some chemistry.
Either way, the Democratic Party and President Obama will tie the Ryan Medicare plan around Romney's neck.
Why give them the red flag
waving it in front of their face? Plus, Ryan is the intellectual leader of the House Republicans. Taking him out, putting him on the ticket, and then if Romney Ryan loses, well, you know, you don't have him in the House guiding that philosophy anymore. And that leaves us once again with Rob Portman. And again, I know that everybody's going to roll their eyes and say, oh, we've been saying this for weeks, it won't be exciting. But that excitement, no matter what happens, that excitement doesn't last that long.
Exactly.
I remember the Republican Party when Bob Dole announced Jack Kemp as the
running mate. Huge spike.
Huge excitement.
They loved it.
And ultimately, Jack Kemp was a tremendous disappointment, not only in his debate against Al Gore, but on the campaign trail, where for the most part, he was kind of saying, well, you know, the Democrats have done things perhaps better than we Republicans.
Oh, Jack Kemp was a disaster as the vice presidential pick. It didn't seem like he knew what a script was, let alone reading from the one that Dole had given him. And while it gave us a lot of respect, it did me, for Bob Dole, that he would pick a guy he couldn't stand, like Jack Kemp, who had said terrible things about him, and put him on the
ticket. They ran against each other in 1988 when George H.W. Bush got the nomination.
No love lost, let's put it mildly. And he was willing to take that man on his ticket because everyone was telling him you need to give the party a good swift kick and get him going and getting him enthusiastic. If Mitt Romney is following the lesson learned in 1996 by Bob Dole, he will not pick a Paul Ryan or a Chris Christie or any of these other people being foisted on him by the conservative media. I mean, Rupert Murdoch's publications and Fox and everyone, they're all trying to get somebody on the ticket they find more exciting than Portman.
And of course, once we have the vice presidential announcement, we can go back to the serious kind of conversation about the campaign that's been going on so far.
He'd ask the middle class to pay more in taxes so that he could give another $250,000 tax cut to people making more than $3 million a year. It's like Robin Hood in reverse. It's Romney Hood.
Okay, that was a moderate hit for the president, Romney Hood. We may hear some more of that at the convention.
Did Romney have a response?
We've been watching the president say a lot of things about me and about my policies, and they're just not right. And if I were to coin a term, it would be Obama-loney. He's serving up a dish which is simply in contradiction of the truth.
Big audience response there. I'm not actually sure he had an audience at that point, so we should be fair.
And if he did have to coin a phrase, that would be the one I would coin.
Obama-loney?
Yeah.
I think we all got the idea. And certainly we'll probably hear some more of this.
You know why he picked baloney? Because there's so much at stake in this election, Ron Elving. I can't believe that came out of my mouth.
The Le Tourette syndrome continues. And you know what? It's not just Romney Hood and Obama-loney. It's been a week of really ugly ads and really ugly turns of the campaign. For example, Mitt Romney was out with this attack on the president for gutting welfare reform.
This bill will help people to go to work so they can stop drawing a welfare check and start drawing a paycheck.
I was not a huge supporter of the federal plan that was signed in 1996.
I would not probably have supported the federal bill that was passed.
The Obama administration quietly offered to issue waivers to the work requirements in the law.
And basically everybody who observed that ad, critiqued that ad, said there were so many falsehoods in it. And I think that one of the reasons Romney was going after this is because he wanted to exaggerate a split between Bill Clinton, who helped orchestrate that 1996 welfare law, and President Obama.
And of course, very shortly after this ad went up, Bill Clinton was out with a statement saying, that's not true. This is not in any sense gutting the welfare reform that I put through in the mid-90s. And, you know, Governor Romney knows as a governor that they were given all of these flexibilities. And that's what's being exercised here, largely on behalf of Republican governors who want waivers. And so that was undercutting. And then there was just, as you say, a sort of a storm of criticism of that ad. But before the week was out,
It wasn't even, look, in fairness, this wasn't an Obama campaign ad, but Priorities USA, which is a pro-Obama group, and it's Bill Burton, Paul Begala, the people who have always worked for President Obama behind this ad. To me, this crossed a line.
I don't know how long she was sick, and I think maybe she didn't say anything because she knew that we couldn't afford the insurance. And then one day she became ill, and I took her up to the Jackson County Hospital. And admitted her for pneumonia, and that's when they found the cancer. And by then, it was stage four. There was nothing they could do for her. And she passed away in 22 days. I do not think Mitt Romney realizes what he's done to anyone. And I do not think Mitt Romney is concerned.
I mean, basically, this is an ad that's accusing Mitt Romney of being somehow responsible for his wife's death.
That's right. And not necessarily that he, through his commercial activities, was responsible for her cancer, but because Bain Capital, during a period of time when the leadership of Bain Capital is in some dispute, it's sort of a murky period of time, during that period of time, Bain took over this man's steelworker, Jos Optics, company, and canceled the health insurance plan that they had at that time. But there is real dispute over whether or not the woman still had health insurance at the time that she was contracting
this
cancer.
At her own job as well.
At her own job. So the facts of this case are quite murky, and obviously the emotionality and the music and this man's own heartbreak are very effective television. The interesting thing is it's not clear how many times this ad has actually been on television.
Well,
it's mostly getting a lot of notoriety because it's in the political conversation and because the Romney campaign and a wide variety of critics have all not only panned the ad but said that's a good example of really slimy, misleading advertising.
I think this truth to that argument, and I think that the purpose of the ad obviously was to bring out Mitt Romney's ties with Bain Capital and this vulture capitalism that many Democrats have accused him of. But as you say, I think many people feel, rightly so, that this has just crossed a line, and a lot of Democrats seem to be kind of queasy about how to respond to it. The Obama campaign could say, well, this is not our campaign ad, but they won't renounce it. But it seems like everybody else certainly is doing so.
Well, while we're talking about blows below the belt, the Romney campaign has also sustained a pretty hard hit and a pretty nasty one from the ongoing controversy about Harry Reid and his allegation that the reason Mitt Romney can't release his tax returns is because it would show he hadn't paid any taxes.
Well,
and he says any taxes
for
a decade.
So the word's out that he hasn't paid any taxes for 10 years. Let him prove that he has paid taxes, because he hasn't.
But what's remarkable about this, and I think a lot of people have called Harry Reid out on this, justifiably, is that Reid comes up and said, look, somebody told me.
A Bain investor.
Yeah, a Bain investor told me that Mitt Romney may not have paid taxes in the last 10 years. Now, when the Republicans went ballistic, and they did go ballistic, they called him
McCarthyism.
A liar, a dirty liar.
A dirty liar. The chairman of the Republican National Committee, Reince Priebus, went on national television and unprompted said, I'm not going to respond to any questions about that Harry Reid. He's a dirty liar.
I think
that's pretty clear how they feel.
Exactly. And yet, and what Harry Reid's saying, look, it's up to Mitt Romney to disprove what I've said, even if I may have made it up. I mean, it's just, you know, just remarkable.
Well, it's obvious what's going on here. They're trying to taunt him into releasing his tax returns.
That's exactly the point, is that whatever Harry Reid said, whatever good or bad Harry Reid was up to, the point is, once again, the conversation goes back to Mitt Romney and his failure to release his tax returns. And I think that's certainly one of the reasons why Romney's favorability numbers have taken a hit, because of the failure to come forward on taxes.
That's right. He was really improving in the favorable, unfavorable polling, largely, of course, as he consolidated his nomination back in the spring. And a lot of Republicans kind of circled around him and said, well, he's our guy now. And so we feel much better about him than we did when he was running against Santorum or whom have you. And so all of a sudden, that progress towards a more favorable rating seems to have dissipated, and he saw his unfavorables in the latest Washington Post ABC News poll go from 45% to 49%. That's a pretty high unfavorable for a guy who's hoping to defeat an incumbent president in November.
You mentioned the name Rick Santorum a short time ago. Rick Santorum is one of the few people, shall we say, the lucky Republicans who will be speaking at the convention in Tampa later this summer, but many other Republicans were shut out, at least so far.
At least so far. Now, among the people I was surprised were not on the list of speakers was Ron Paul. Now, here's obviously obviously a guy who speaks for a segment of the Republican Party. Maybe it's only 10-15% of the Republican Party, but these are intense followers, and they would very much like to see their man at the convention. And instead, we're seeing his son, Rand Paul, which may be a brilliant solution because you don't get all of the negatives that go with Ron Paul, you know, his foreign policy stuff, his maybe we shouldn't be tough with Iran stuff. But you do get a situation where he cannot trash you because he is being defensive about his own son, Rand Paul, who is getting a featured speaking.
And perhaps one of the reasons for that is Ron Paul has yet to endorse Mitt Romney, and Rand Paul has endorsed Romney. And I think part of, you know, in the old days, they used to have rivals being nominated at conventions. Now it's basically controlled by the forces of the likely nominee. So just as Bill Clinton in 1992 would not allow Jerry Brown or Bob Casey to speak because, you know, they didn't like what they said about him, Mitt Romney's forces will control this convention. Nothing for Newt Gingrich, nothing for Rick Perry, it
Herman
looks like.
Cain.
Well, Herman Cain. But there's some dispute whether Donald Trump is going to speak. And
Is there any real dispute about that, or is it just in the mind of the Donald that he might speak?
Well, I think it would be absolutely insane to have him speak on the convention.
My point exactly. Yeah. It's only in the mind of the Donald.
And we still haven't heard anything about Sarah Palin yet, but we do have, shall we say, old faces speaking at the convention. We have John McCain. You remember him. He was in all the papers 4 years ago.
Yes, he's a good old face.
He is. But we do have Ted Cruz. And, you know, so in many ways, we keep talking about the great Tea Party victory and how the establishment is taking a blow as it did in Texas a couple of weeks ago.
And in Indiana.
Right. But in other states as well. But the fact is, Ted Cruz is a great speaker, is a rising star in the Republican
Party. Oh, absolutely.
Party, and he's the kind of guy you'd probably want at a convention giving a rock'em sock'em speech.
Absolutely. And another guy who can speak Spanish. Of course, his background is Cuban as well.
Right.
He will not be on the national ticket now or anytime soon because he was born in Canada. But he is a guy who can be a rising star in Texas, could be governor, could be senator, could be a major national figure as a senator.
Supreme Court justice.
There you have it.
You heard it here last.
So one slight setback, I would say, for the Tea Party this week in Missouri, where Todd Akin, who claims to be a Tea Party kind of guy and likes the Tea Party and says good things about it and hopes it will support him, was really not their favorite candidate, and he won the nomination there to face Claire McCaskill this fall.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you can describe Missouri as a defeat for the Tea Party. All three Republican candidates who are running, Todd Akin, John Brunner, and Sarah Steelman, they finished in that order, all were very, very conservative. Matter of fact, Claire McCaskill, who looked at polls and said that, looks like I'm doing better against Todd Akin than anybody else.
She went after him in her ads.
It's saying, you know, he's too conservative for Missouri, and that's exactly what a Tea Party person needs to hear. So I'm not sure the Tea Party lost in Missouri.
But which one did Sarah Palin campaign for?
Well, Palin certainly campaigned for Sarah Steelman. But
that may have had more to do with the Mama Grizzly thing than it had to do with ideology.
Mike Huckabee campaigned for Todd Akin. So,
now, Todd Akin also has a little exposure in the Mike Huckabee direction there, Mike Huckabee being a former Baptist minister. Todd Akin is a very forthright evangelical Christian.
Right, very popular with evangelicals. And he also comes from a strong base in the St. Louis suburbs. You know, it's always be careful what you wish for. Claire McCaskill, you know, saying, I got the guy I want. I got the Republican I want. Be careful what you wish for. We always talk about how the Democrats love the thought of running against Ronald Reagan in 1980, that extremist, that actor.
Right.
And as I recall, Reagan won.
Yes. And in fact, in this particular case, Todd Akin is the most seasoned professional politician among these people. He will know how to deal with Claire McCaskill. He does have that base in the St. Louis suburbs, which are very important if the Democrat is going to win in a statewide race in Missouri. And he will do extraordinarily well in another Republican part of the state, the southwestern part of the state around Springfield, and that is, you know, the world headquarters of the Assembly of God, and it is an extraordinarily evangelical area, and they will probably love Todd Akin to death.
And let me tell you exactly what this race is about with Senator Claire McCaskill. This campaign is about reclaiming our godly values, rebuilding the American dream, and restoring the America that we love.
Amen.
And this,
one thing Todd Akin didn't do that the two other Republicans did do, he didn't trash talk his fellow Republicans. Steelman and Brunner really went after each other pretty with negative commercials. Akin stayed away from that. And that could help, you know, party unity in beating Claire McCaskill. For the Republicans to win control of the Senate, they've got to win McCaskill's seat in Missouri.
You know, and there's a lesson here for the four Republicans running for the Senate nomination in Wisconsin next Tuesday. Tommy Thompson is by far and away the best known. He's an icon of Republican politics in Wisconsin, four times elected governor. But the three other candidates are all running to his right and all saying that Tommy Thompson is too much of a compromiser, a man whose time has passed. And they are running ads against each other most of the time. They're attacking each other very directly and trying to become the alternative to Tommy Thompson.
Conservative alternative. Right.
Right now, it looks to me as though those three are going to basically knock each other off and Tommy Thompson will walk away with the nomination.
Well, that was the difference that we saw in both Texas and Indiana. It was the Tea Party conservative against the establishment status quo candidate.
Mano a mano.
Exactly.
Simple choice.
Exactly.
But Debbie Fisher in Nebraska, another case of the third person, the third least well-known person.
When the other two were knocking each other
That's
out.
That's right. And she was the beneficiary of that three-way go.
So Tommy Thompson, again, is not a new face like Deb Fisher in Nebraska or Murdoch in Indiana. But Tommy Thompson could win it. And a latest poll came out this week that among the three or four Republicans matched up against Tammy Baldwin, the congresswoman from Madison, or congresswoman from Madison, Wisconsin, Tommy Thompson is the only one with a slight lead. Everybody else trails. Some other results from Tuesday's primaries we should note. In Michigan, for the Republican nomination to take on Debbie Stabenow, Pete Hoekstra, the former congressman who ran for governor and lost 2 years ago, Pete Hoekstra got the Republican nomination pretty easily against Clark Durant, who was also backed by a lot of Tea Party folks. Hoekstra obviously is a underdog against Stabenow in November. But two House races also on Tuesday that I thought were kind of interesting.
In Michigan.
One in Michigan and one in Missouri, both cases of two Democratic incumbents forced to run against each other because of Republican legislature redistricting. Both states lose a congressional seat. Yep. In Missouri, in St. Louis, William Lacey Clay, the son of longtime former Congressman Bill Clay, he was pushed against Russ Carnahan, Congressman from the 3rd District.
Both, sort of north side, south side St. Louis
both
contest.
Both Carnahan, right, and both Carnahan and Clay come from, you know, prominent families in Missouri, but basically the Republicans tried to wipe out one of the districts, and Carnahan basically blamed Clay for working with the Republicans to keep his district as
African-American as possible.
And it was. And Clay clobbered Carnahan almost 2-1. It was closer in Michigan, in the Detroit area district. Gary Peters, a white incumbent Democrat backed by labor, defeated Hanson Clark, African-American who...
Half-African-American.
Half-African, that's right. But 2 years ago, he defeated Carolyn
Cheeks
Kilpatrick. Yes. And this is one of the few instances in the country where you can have a white incumbent representing a majority African-American district.
There's also, what is it, Memphis?
Memphis, right, Steve Cohen in Memphis. And I think Elliot Engel in the Bronx is not African-American.
But non-white.
Right, non-white, yeah. So that should be it for that.
And just briefly, we don't normally talk about state legislatures, but Sam Brownback, the Republican governor of Kansas, was interested in running something of a purge of some of the more moderate members of his own party in the state legislature, in the state Senate, and that was very successful. The more conservative challengers who ran against those moderate Republican Kansas state senators won.
Kansas is known for having fratricidal relationships between the two wings of the Republican Party, the conservatives, and the very conservatives. And the very conservatives, backed by Sam Brownback, won impressively on Tuesday.
Two wings and hang up. Isn't that right, Ken?
I think so.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You know, I've used that joke before. You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
You use jokes more than once? I'm Ron Elving.
Wait, last week we didn't hear who I was. And I'm Ken Reardon.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.